If you have your Bibles and would like to follow along, we will be in the book of Matthew in chapter 20. Matthew chapter 20, and we'll be reading the first 16 verses of the chapter there, talking about one of the parables of Jesus. And we'll read through the parable, and I read through this earlier this week, and it stuck with me for the message today. I'm a little nervous. I guess in general, maybe I tend to avoid this parable a little bit just because there's a lot about it that I don't fully understand, as there probably is much of the scriptures. Some of them I feel like I have a little more understanding of than others. But I do want to read through the parable, and I know there's some things that we can glean from it and talk about maybe some of the different things. I read some commentaries and just tried to pray about it and meditate on it. And at the end of it all, I certainly can't pretend to know the full extent of what Jesus was trying to teach with this parable, but only hopefully can scratch the surface a little bit for our sermon today. Matthew chapter 20, starting with verse 1, Jesus speaking here, he says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is an householder, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard. And when he had agreed with the laborers for a penny a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and said unto them, Go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right I will give you. And they went their way. Again he went out about the sixth and ninth hour and did likewise. And about the 11th hour he went out and found others standing idle, and saith unto them, Why stand ye here all the day idle? They say unto him, Because no man hath hired us. He saith unto them, Go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right, that shall ye receive. So when even was come, the Lord of the vineyard saith unto his steward, Call the laborers, and give them their hire, beginning from the last unto the first. And when they came that were hired, about the 11th hour, they received every man a penny. But when the first came, they supposed that they should have received more, and they likewise received every man a penny. And when they had received it, they murmured against the goodman of the house, saying, These last have wrought but 1 hour, and thou hast made them equal unto us, which have borne the burden and heat of the day. But he answered one of them and said, Friend, I do thee no wrong. Didst not thou agree with me for a penny? Take that thine is, and go thy way. I will give unto this last even as unto thee. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? Is thine eye evil because I am good? So the last shall be first, and the first last. For many be called, but few chosen." And we'll stop our reading at the end of the parable there. So we have the picture, and Jesus says that this is a parable, a story, if you will, to relate to the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven was a popular topic for Jesus as he was given his parables, and there were a lot of the parables, a lot of the stories that he taught and the references he made to describe the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven was something that they were having a difficult time understanding. I'd say it's something that we have a difficult time understanding today. There's a lot of opinions on what the kingdom is and how the kingdom is going to be presented throughout the ages, and we won't get into all of that. But we have the kingdom of heaven, and so this story is to relate to that. And on the surface, we have the parable itself. We have the story. And the story is that there was a householder, and he had a vineyard, and so he met some people, some laborers, and they had an agreement, and so that they would go and they would work in the vineyard for the penny. Now, a penny in the scripture here is a little bit different than the penny that we have in our currency today. And a penny was probably a denarius, which was a day's wages in that day. So it wasn't that the householder, the master, if you will, in the parable, it wasn't that he was being unfair to the servants. It's not that he was underpaying them. It's not that he was trying to harm them. He agreed with them, and there was a mutual agreement. Both he and the laborers that he hired agreed that they would work the full day and that they would receive what was considered at that time to be a full day's wage for their work. So that was the agreement that was set up. A day at that time, a day's work from the reading that I had, the end of the day or the end of the work day would have probably been about 6 p.m., so they would have started their day at 6 a.m. They probably would have worked 12 hours from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. I assume that there would have been some time where they would have eaten. I don't know that they had a lunch break, but they probably had to have some sort of water and food throughout that 12-hour period. But they were working that 12-hour period from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. And so it says that the householder, the one that owned the vineyard, that he came across other people throughout the day. Some he came across at the third hour, and that would have been at 9 a.m. And he told them that he said he saw them standing idle in the marketplace, so they weren't working. I'm assuming if they weren't working, they weren't getting paid that day. And so he encouraged them to go to work in the vineyard. He didn't tell them exactly how much. So with these individuals, the parable doesn't tell us that they agreed on the exact amount that they would be paid. They weren't going to be working a full day, so the expectation to many would have been that they would not have been paid the full day's wage. But the householder, the owner of the vineyard, said, "And whatsoever is right, I will give you." And I guess that was enough for them because it says they went their way. And he did the same thing at the sixth hour, which would have been noon. He did the same thing at the ninth hour, which would have been 3 p.m. And then we get to the 11th hour, which would have been 5 p.m., just an hour before the end of the day. And it says that he went out and found others standing idle, and saith unto them, "Why stand ye here all the day idle?" So they had not worked pretty much the entire day. Now, whether or not how desperately they had looked for work, we don't know. Perhaps they had not tried very hard. Perhaps they had tried diligently to find someone that they could work for. If they were hired laborers, if that was the way that they earned their living, perhaps they had honestly looked for someone and had not found anyone that needed the work. Obviously, they had not come across the one that had owned this vineyard, this particular person. But their response was, "No man hath hired us." So they had been standing idle in the marketplace. They had not been working. They said no man had hired them. How difficult they had looked, I don't know, but no one had hired them to work. So he tells them the same thing that he told the ones. It would have been, the third hour to the 11th, it would have been, 8 hours previously. He says, essentially, "Go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right, that shall ye receive." So they were only going to be working an hour. They had already missed the heat of the day. They were working just from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m., and they went and they did the work. And all that they knew, from what we understand, is that they would receive what was right, something fair, which in our minds would have been a twelfth of a denarius. It would have been 1/12 of a day's work. If in our minds, the way a lot of times we think about wages and what is right and what is earned, if you will. So it's the end of the day. We get to 6 p.m. and it's time for the laborers to collect their wages. And the goodman of the household, the owner, the lord of the vineyard, it says, called his steward and said, "We're going to pay them out. We're going to start with the last ones." And so the one that had worked an hour received the denarius. They received the full day's wages. It's not what they had earned. They had not earned the right to have that denarius given to them, but they were given it from the owner of the vineyard, the lord of the vineyard. As were the ones that were hired in the ninth hour, in the sixth hour, in the third hour, and then we get to the ones that were hired at the beginning of the day that had agreed upon the wage. And they had heard, at least through the grapevine, or they had seen somehow, they knew what each of the groups had been paid, because they had been paid first. And so in their minds, they were going to get a raise. They were going to get a raise compared to what they had agreed to, because surely if these that had worked for an hour received the full day's wage, that they were going to receive more. And they were disappointed when that didn't happen. In fact, they complained. It says they murmured against the goodman of the house. So they complained against him. And their complaint was that there was this group that was called at the 11th hour, that only worked for 1 hour, that didn't have to bear the heat of the day, and they received the denarius. And so they thought it was unfair for them to get paid the same thing. Now, I don't know what it would have been like to work 12 hours in a vineyard in this time in ancient Israel. I worked on a tobacco farm a lot growing up. I know kind of what it was like to work a day on the tobacco farm. There were probably days where we worked close to 12 hours. And we had tractors and setters and all sorts of things that were to help us in that work that I imagine they didn't have when they were working. I do have some experience of what it was like to work in the heat of the day. The morning wasn't so bad. I was still half asleep in the morning a lot of times, but the heat wasn't so bad. It was still cool. A lot of times it was almost too cool. But then it would warm up, and then you get along about 12 to 3, 4 p.m. in the summertime in Middle Tennessee, and it was hot. Sometimes we would have if you were on the setter, that was kind of nice. I liked that. I grew up on a tobacco farm, and so when I was really young, I wasn't old enough for them to say that I could ride the tobacco setter. The setter, and some of you have probably worked in tobacco, you know exactly what I'm talking about, or backer, as you'll probably hear it around here. But they have these carousel setters now where you can just throw the plant in the cup and it gets dropped in the ground. They may have had those, but we didn't have one when I was growing up. My dad didn't have one when we were setting tobacco. We had the ones where you had the arms that would rotate around. And you and another person would take turns putting those plants in the arms, and you had to hold them in there long enough for the clamp to close over the plant, and it would rotate around and drop it in the ground. And you could just have people ride the setter, but there were a few problems. Depending on how effective the people were that were riding the setter, sometimes you might get a little jumbled up and you might miss a plant. Or in some not so great scenarios, you might accidentally put it in the arm upside down, and so when it gets put in the ground, the roots are sticking straight up. Sometimes you might put it in to where you put the roots in too far up, and so when it tried to set it in the ground, it would just lay it on top of it. Sometimes you might put it too far down, it would set it in the ground, and the ground would cover it up. There were times where you might do everything right, but the ground itself was the ground was rough, and so it might not set the plant in the ground appropriately. So for some people, that might be good enough, but we were kind of a small family farm, and so we wanted every plant to have as much of a chance of survival as possible. So you had the unlucky individual, that was the resetter. And the resetter was the one that walked behind the setter to make sure that any plants that were upside down or on top of the ground or buried under the ground, essentially, or missed, they would have a bunch of plants with them, and they would put the plants in that were missed. So the goal of the resetter was to fix all the issues that resulted from the people riding the setter. When I was little, I was deemed too young to ride the setter, so I had the resetter task, which I did not enjoy. I did not like being the one that had to always walk behind the setter. The setter, I don't remember, some setters had like a shade covering where at least you didn't have the sun beating down on you. I don't remember when I was really young. I know some of the setters I have been on had that. But at least you were getting to sit on a maybe not so comfortable seat, but you were at least sitting and getting driven around the tobacco field. The resetter had to walk. And when it was hot, that was a pretty miserable job for me. I was quite excited when I was old enough to get to ride the setter. And I wanted to do a really, really good job so that I was deemed as a good fit to be on the tobacco setter. And I actually, maybe it's a little bit of pride, I felt like I did a pretty good job. I think that I was able to hit most every time the plants that I was supposed to hit and catch some. It was a little bit of almost a team sport, if you will. You and the other person were working together, and if they got bundled up, like they ran out of plants or their plants got tangled up, you might have to catch two or three in a row until they could recover. And I rode with my mom and my grandmother, my grandfather, my dad drove the tractor. I did it as a job over the summer for Nikki Wilson, the one that presented me at my ordination. I set tobacco for him for many years and worked with some of his family members, and I felt like I was able to get pretty good at it. So I have a little bit of an understanding. I can relate somewhat to their experience. I'm sure my experience was much easier and much less hot, much less intense work than probably what they had to go through the day at the vineyard. But I do understand what they talk about, the heat of the day. If I was told on any given day that I didn't have to work the full day, I just had to come in at 5 and get off at 6, I would have been pretty excited about that. Because by that time, the heat of the day was mostly gone, you were finishing up, and it was just, that wouldn't have been a good deal. And I can relate, and I don't know about you, but I can imagine if I had been one of the laborers that was hired at the beginning of the day, and I had seen all the things transpire. I had seen these people that had been sitting around idle in the marketplace for 11 hours that came and worked in the cool of the day for an hour, and I saw them receive their wage. I can imagine in my mind that I might have had a very similar expectation and a similar disappointment that they had. The goodman, when he heard their murmuring, the goodman of the house, the owner of the vineyard, he explained to them that he did them no wrong, and he didn't. They had an agreement. They agreed that they were going to work for the penny, for the day's wage. It was the fair wage for what they worked, and he gave them what they had agreed to. He didn't give them more than they had agreed to, that they had hoped for, but he did not short them in any way. He did not, he honored his commitment, and he paid what was fair. So he told them, first of all, that was his first argument, is the fact that, didst not thou agree with me for a penny? That's what they had agreed to. That's what they had vowed to work for, so it was certainly no wrong. And then his other response was, is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? And we'll focus in a little bit on that particular response from the householder. So this is the parable that's presented to us, and perhaps those of us that have worked in the heat of the day, have worked a physical job, can have some relation to what they were experiencing, what they were going through. It's always good if you read through the parables to try to be able to relate to them. Some of these things maybe seem distant to us. I have experience in working in tobacco. I have no experience in working with sheep. And so a lot of the times when it talks about the shepherd and the sheep, there's probably things about that parable that I don't understand because I don't have that experience. But it's good for us. The parables are trying to take heavenly concepts, spiritual concepts, and put them in a way that we can understand them through our human experiences. That's the purpose of the parables. And so the more that we can relate to these things, the more that we can try to understand them, at least from a physical side of things, then that can help to teach us the spiritual lessons that Christ is trying to teach. As we move into the spiritual things of the lesson, that's where things get a little bit tricky, and I'm sure that there are things about it that I don't understand fully. As he gives this, and as he finishes up the parable, he says, "So the last shall be first, and the first last, for many be called, but few chosen." And I've always found that to be a little bit odd, because at least on initial glance, it doesn't necessarily strike you as being the lesson taught from the parable. It's in fact the same thing that he said at the end of chapter 19 in verse 30. He also says, "But many that are first shall be last, and the last shall be first." He says this when the apostles are talking to him. He has just talked with a young man, and that young man has asked him about the commandments. And about the young man asked him, "Good master, what good thing shall I do that I may have eternal life?" And Jesus and the young man have a discussion, and Jesus finally tells the young man, "If thou wilt be perfect, go and sell that thou hast, and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me." The young man went away sorrowful because he had great possessions. And so the thought of having to sell all that he had was too great for him. He had too many possessions, and so he was sorrowful that Jesus would ask him to sell what he had to give to the poor and follow him. Jesus responds that, essentially saying it is impossible, if you will, from man's standards, for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of heaven. And so his disciples were amazed at that, and he said, "With men this is impossible, with God all things are possible." So we have this dialogue where it's impossible, at least with men, for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of heaven, being that those that are rich will often look to their possessions, look to their things of this world, and not want to give those things up to follow Christ. And we understand that Christ doesn't want a half-hearted servant. He doesn't want someone that is going to hold on to their possessions and treat their possessions as an idol, that we have to be willing to forsake all to give everything up. His disciples answered that that's what they had done. Then answered Peter and said unto him, "Behold, we have forsaken all and followed thee. What shall we have therefore?" So Peter, I don't think Peter was being, perhaps he was being boastful, but I believe it was a recognition of Peter that what Jesus was describing is what many of them had done. Jesus had called them, and it says that straightway they had left their nets, they had left their families, they had left their professions, and they had followed Jesus. And so Peter had mentioned this, and Jesus at the end of chapter 29, he says, "Verily I say unto you, that you which have followed me, in the regeneration when the Son of Man shall sit in the throne of his glory, ye also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And every one that hath forsaken houses, or brethren, or sisters, or father, or mother, or wife, or children, or lands, for my name's sake shall receive an hundredfold, and shall inherit everlasting life. But many that are first shall be last, and the last shall be first." Now I read that to say that I don't have the full understanding of exactly how those things are fully connected, but I believe that they are. I believe that the same thing that Jesus was talking about with his disciples, the same lesson and the same thing that he was trying to teach them at the end of chapter 29, Jesus is carrying that forward into chapter 20. There's still this same thought of the last shall be first and the first shall be last. Many be called, but few chosen. So as we start to understand and look to the parable that Jesus has given, there are some things I think that we can glean that are still very beneficial. As we look, and it says that the master says, "Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own?" I mentioned that I would be in danger of having the same thoughts that the laborers did that were hired at the beginning of the day. I think many of us, if we're honest, would be guilty and have been guilty of looking around us in the world and comparing what others have, comparing what others have received, comparing ourselves and looking and wondering. We even have songs. There's a song called Farther Along, and there's a question in the song about how those that are giving, you know, that live lives in an evil fashion, that that are maybe they're not generous toward others, maybe they're just living life how they want to live it, but that they seem to receive good things, and that how those that are trying to follow the ways of Christ, that are trying to live a Christian life and trying to live by God's principles, that sometimes it seems that they receive the bad things of life. And how can these things be? And we ask ourselves these things sometimes. And the mistake that the laborers made, the mistake that we often make, is to try to take our understanding of what is fair and to apply it to God. A lot of people want things to be fair nowadays. I'd say that's something that it seems that children seem to learn to say at a very early age. That's not fair. And our definition of fair can be distorted. It can be wrong. Fair in our minds, and I can also relate to getting paid a wage. I get paid for the time that I work. I'm on salary. I don't get paid if I work over the allotted hours. I don't get paid extra. But the expectation is I'm going to work so many hours a week, and I get paid for those. And so for someone to be able to come in and work half as much as I do, or a tenth as much as I do, and get paid the same amount that I do, I would have a hard time with that. It would not feel fair. It would feel, even though I have that agreement with my employer, even though we have that agreement, if you will, when I joined the company, I was told how much they would pay me, and I knew the expectations of that it was going to be a certain hours in a work week, and I agreed to that. But it would still be really hard for me, I think, even now, something that I still need to learn, to see someone, and it can be frustrating to have a coworker that doesn't really seem to care or doesn't seem to work that hard, and to know that they're getting paid just as much, it can certainly not feel fair. What we have to understand is that the resources that we have, what we're talking about, is God's. We're all His creation. If we understand that God is the householder, He is the one represented by the owner of the vineyard, that represents God. I think that's pretty clear in the parable. And just as the one that owned the vineyard, it was his money. And so he told the laborers that, it's my money. I gave you exactly what we agreed to. If I choose to give these other people more than what they deserved, is it not my right to do so? And it was his right. It was his money. It was his choice to make. God, so it is lawful for individuals, for beings, to do what they will with their own. Well, what is God's? Well, everything. Our lives are God's. Our health is God's. Our breath, our amount of years in this life is God's. The possessions, the resources, the paper that we have decided that we can print it in a certain way and put certain ink on it, and that paper all of a sudden becomes extremely valuable. And depending on the type and how much of the ink and the design of that ink, some of that paper is a lot more valuable than others. And we have come to accept that. We have cash, we have coins, we have these things, and even the coins that have, and this money is supposedly backed by a gold standard, which we'll leave that for a different conversation. But even the gold or the silver, it has value because we've decided it has value. It's nothing more than metal that has been dug out of the ground. Diamonds are extremely expensive. Diamonds that are cut a certain way and that look a certain way are very, very, very expensive. They're nothing more than coal that has been compressed into extreme circumstances to create this thing that we've decided looks very beautiful. And so we'll pay a great deal of money for it. that money being paper that we've decided is value. And I kind of make light of these things. We have to have some sort of a currency system. Even if it's in bartering, we still have to associate value of things to be able to function in our society in some way. So I make light of these things, but it's all God's. And when we really get down to it, all the value we put on it is only there because we've decided it should be there. It's nothing more than paper and metal and these different things that we have associated value to. But it's not ours. It's God's. And so God has the right to do what He will with His. What does that mean? Well, first of all, it means that we, and I've said this before, and I'll say it again, we need to be very careful that when we're thinking about people and God, that we're trying as hard as we can to keep our eyes on God and not to be looking around at each other. Comparison is the thief of joy is a saying that kind of goes around, and there's merit to it. You start comparing yourself with others. You start looking around at what others have and what you don't have, and it will rob you of joy. Those laborers that started the day, if they had not known, if they had not seen, if they had not compared themselves to the other laborers that had started later, they probably would have got to the end of their day and been very content and happy to receive their day's wages that they had agreed to. It was only when they looked around, saw what other people were getting, that they became unhappy and dissatisfied with what they received. So I would encourage each and every one of us, those of us that are in the church, those of us that are church members, I would encourage us to not be looking around, to not be comparing ourselves with other churches, to not be comparing ourselves with other brothers or other sisters within the church, but that we would try our best to recognize that our relationship with God is between us and God, and their relationship with God is between them and God. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't need to encourage each other. That doesn't mean that if we have a brother or a sister that is in the wrong, the Scriptures give us a framework for what we're supposed to do. I preached about discipline a few weeks ago in one of the more difficult sermons that I've had to preach. I don't think the answer is that the goal of this isn't that we just be ourselves and do our own thing and let everyone else do whatever they want to do. That's not I don't believe that is the scriptural answer. But let us not be comparing ourselves. Let us not be looking around at each other. It will rob you of your joy in a situation in which you might otherwise be content with. There's a lot of discontentment in this world. There's a lot of discontentment. There's a lot of discontentment that have more things than probably, I would venture to say, 3/4 of the population of this world. There are those that have considerably more than 75% of the population of this world, probably more, and yet they are very dissatisfied because they have a lot less than the people around them. You take their house, you take their car, you take their possessions, you take their job, and you go and you transfer that to some other location in this world, and all of a sudden they would probably be feeling pretty good about themselves and what they have. It's not in the things itself, it's in those things compared to what we see others have. It may be your physical appearance, and there are so many people out there that are comparing themselves physically to others, and there's a lot of times where people are shamed because of the way that they look and made fun of because of the way that they look. There's a lot of money that goes into products and clothing and all these different things that we use to try to make ourselves look a certain way. And the only reason that we've decided to do that is because of the value that has been placed on looking a certain way. You go to a different culture, you go to a different time period, and those same things probably were not what was seen as beautiful or attractive at that time. And we probably wouldn't do them. We compare so many things. And we need to not. The next thing that I would want to mention is the fact that when God says, "Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own?" And we understand that it's all God's. Our health and our possessions and all these things are God's. And that lesson was for the children too. It's not just for the church. But I think it's a lesson for all of us to understand that what the Bible teaches us about comparisons to others. God, it's all His. Why would the master of the household give the full day's wages to those that just work the hour? Why do it? Obviously, he didn't value his money as much as some of us maybe do. He didn't put as much stock into his money, because if he had, he probably would have paid the minimum amount he thought he could get away with to each group. But no, he paid the day's wages to those that worked the hour. Why? It's not what they had earned. It's called grace. It's called unmerited favor. And God has a lot of it. Actually, God is grace. It's not just something He has. It's a part of who He is. How that grace gets shed across to His creation is God's business. It's unmerited favor. So when we look around and it appears as though others are receiving a greater portion of God's grace than we truly are like the laborers. We have no leg to stand on. We try to, but we really have no business going to God and saying, "Look, God, they've got all this. They've got their perfect health. They've got a beautiful family that seems to have everything put together," which probably is not true. But there are people, and it just seems like God has blessed them abundantly, and we may feel like we're on the short end of the blessing stick sometimes. And if we compare, then we can fall into the trap of not being content with our blessings because we look around and we see others that seem to be blessed more. And maybe they are. God is not required to bless every single individual in equal measure. He's not. There's nowhere in the Bible where He's bound to have to give everybody the exact same thing all the time. It's grace. It's unmerited favor. It's things that we haven't earned. If we've earned it, we have a right to expect it. Which is one way reason I want to be a little careful with the parable as we get into some of these spiritual elements. None of us deserve God's grace. None of us have earned it. None of us have earned the blessings of God. We are all recipients. We are all receivers of the gift of His grace. And by it being a gift, it means that there was no obligation for God to give it to us. He gave it to us because He felt like it in His sovereign will. And if it was just us, if I was the only person in this world and I recognized what I had earned, which is nothing, actually what I've earned through my sin, through my actions, through my rebellion, what I have earned is eternal separation from God, from my Creator. What I have received is so much more than that. What I have received is a Savior that took my sins upon Him and shed His blood for me, that conquered death in the grave, so that when I put my trust in Him, I do not have to ever be separated from God. I don't have to bear my sins. I don't have to bear their shame. I don't have to bear their guilt. I have forgiveness. It is a gift from God, and I gladly receive it. I didn't earn it. I wasn't this great worker for God. It's not because I'm your pastor. It's not because I was the pastor's kid. It's not because I had some great faith that I mustered on my own. It's not because I was following all the things in the Bible in a perfect way. It wasn't me. It was a gift. Salvation is a gift. Did I repent? Did I put my trust in Jesus? Absolutely. But it was by the gift of God that I'm saved. Every blessing I have, the health that I have been amazingly blessed with good health in my life. One of our sisters has talked about her granddaughter and how she's just had health struggles just about since she was born. And that's just been her lot in life. And it is difficult. There are those that they just have health. It's not... Now, there are those we make poor choices. There are those that eat horribly, don't exercise, and don't do any of the things that we're told to do in order to take care of our health. And sometimes we face the consequences of our choices. There are those that have worked very physical jobs all their lives, and their bodies toward the end of their lives are just absolutely worn out. It's a result of choices. I'm not saying they were wrong choices, but choices. And yet there are those that they didn't choose anything. They have been sick. They have had poor health in some way from the time they were born, whether it's their being blind or deaf or dumb or lame or just having some sort of a disease, children with cancer. There's a lot of things that if you look out into this world and you start to compare, if you start to compare yourself with others, sometimes it can make you feel about this small, which is probably a step in the right direction. There's a lot of times we can look and we don't understand why certain people go through the things that they have to go through. We don't understand why we have to go through the things that we have to go through sometimes. And yet we have to take a step back and say it is by grace. By grace that we have what we have. If we have good health, it is by His grace. It's a gift. And if God doesn't bestow that gift in equal measure, and He doesn't, we can see that in our world. We know that God doesn't give equal health to every individual. We know that He doesn't give equal amount of life to every individual. It's grace. The householder gave the denarius to all of the workers because of his grace, not because they had earned it. And it's his. And it is lawful. It is right. It is just for him to do with his what he will. That concept is very challenging. It's challenging for us, let's be real. We all, I think, see situations and have experiences in life where it's difficult for us to really see God's grace. And I think that concept we see is just not present in so much of the world today. That is questioning God, that is blaspheming God, that is against God, because they don't see how a just and holy God can do this or this or allow this. They want His grace to be bestowed upon individuals in equal measure. They want to tell God how His grace needs to be shed. And if God doesn't shed His grace the way that we sometimes think He should, then we can sometimes think that God is in the wrong when He's not. Now, if we start to look at this in a few other ways, we have to understand that this was a pivotal time. The gospel had been, the Jews. And that was about to change. The Jews had murmured. They had rejected. They were in the process of rejecting God's Messiah, the Messiah that they had been waiting for. Jesus came and they didn't accept him. And the gospel was about to be opened up to the Gentiles, to other nations outside of the Jewish people. The Gentiles had not always had the gospel present with them. The Gentiles had not always been God's people. And I believe in some ways, as Jesus was talking about the last shall be first and the first last, for many be called but few chosen, I think in one way Jesus is representing the fact that there are going to be new people called that had not been called previously. There are going to be new people that the gospel is going to be presented to, as Peter was instructed to go and preach to Cornelius, as Paul was instructed to go and be the apostle to the Gentiles. That maybe doesn't have as much relevance for us, or as much, well, it has a lot of relevance for us. We're, most all of us are Gentiles, so we're very thankful that the grace of God, God didn't have to bring the gospel to the Gentiles. God could have still been God and kept the gospel message with the Jewish people only. But by His grace, it was opened up to the Gentiles. You see, we don't have a right to the gospel. We haven't earned the gospel. It is by grace. It is a gift that the gospel has been presented to us. So we are very thankful that God, in His grace, in His sovereign will, allowed the gospel to be opened up to the Gentile peoples that we might be saved. I think if we look at it another way, sometimes I think we get the wrong idea that the goal is to go to heaven. The goal is to go to heaven. That's the goal. And sometimes, if we're not careful, we sometimes get the thought of, what's the minimum amount I have to do to still get to the end goal of going to heaven? And it was discussed in Sunday school a few weeks ago about how, if we knew when we were going to die, would we wait until right before the moment to put our trust in God and repent and be saved? And that comes along with this idea, right? That's the minimum, right? Can I live the life I want to live, do the things I want to do, be my own person, and figure out how, right before it's going to be too late, I can go to God and go to heaven and everything's going to be great? Sometimes those of us that were rocked in the Baptist cradle, so to speak, those of us that grew up with it, maybe were saved at an early age, and if we're not careful, sometimes the journey can seem burdensome. Sometimes the journey can seem like working in the heat of the day. It's not supposed to be that way. But if we're honest with ourselves, I would say we're all guilty of feeling the heavy weight of the Christian life, of seeing our friends, seeing those around us that can just do whatever they want, whenever they want, and sometimes perhaps we maybe get a little jealous. Comparing again, you see. But I want to make clear that the end goal is not just to go to heaven. I don't think Jesus' teachings, that He was not giving us the blueprint. He was not giving us the set of directions, the easiest way to get to heaven and do the littlest possible. In reality, those that are saved at a young age, that's by God's grace. It is a gift. Sometimes we look and see what we've had to forsake, what we've had to give up. People have had to give up a variety of different things throughout their life for the Christian cause. Maybe you've had to give up your time. Well, certainly you've had to give up your time. That's a hard thing for people to give up. Sometimes it's easy to be able to sleep in on Sunday mornings, to go fishing, to go hunting, to go to ball games, to watch sports, to do a lot of different things. And it's a sacrifice. It is a sacrifice for people to consistently show up for the services that a church has. It means that you can't participate in things that other people do. It means that you have to live differently. And sometimes that can be hard. Sometimes it means forsaking houses, brethren, sisters, father, mother, wife, children, lands. Sometimes it means sacrificing your life and laying it down, as many martyrs have. And we look at these things sometimes, and we look at it as the cost being great. We look at it as those that have to give up these things, for someone to have to give up their house and maybe go be a missionary somewhere where they live in a thatched hut of some kind, if they have that. To give up all their possessions because there's no place for them where they're going to be laboring. That can seem burdensome. That can seem heavy. That can seem like a great sacrifice. Those that don't have the backing of their families and perhaps have to deal with strife in their families because of their choice to follow Christ. That can seem as a great sacrifice. But the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven, as Jesus is describing here, is an upside-down kingdom. Brother Danny Chandler preached a sermon on that one time. It's an upside-down kingdom. And Jesus makes that point here where he says, "The first shall be last, and the last first." For those that have forsaken those things, for my name's sake, Jesus speaking here, shall receive an hundredfold and shall inherit everlasting life. You see, we sometimes go through our Christian life trying to figure out how little we actually can get away with giving up. But in truth, the more we give, the more we receive. The more we forsake, the more we gain. It's a difficult concept, but one that Jesus consistently provides in his teachings. I would encourage all of us, put your eyes on Jesus. Let's try not to look around. Let's try not to compare. Recognize the blessings in our lives, the gift that we have from God by His grace. And if tomorrow it's taken away, it was never ours to begin with. That's hard. That's hard, but it's truth. Let's try to recognize how blessed we are to have the things that we do. And I would encourage us as we go along the pilgrim's journey, let's not look at it as, can we do the minimum? But let's recognize that the last shall be first. And the more we have to forsake, the more we give, the more we shall receive in the kingdom of heaven.